This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org. and www.acornradio.org. Podcasts will be available to show on these websites and at affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today we're talking to Sayu Bojwani, who is the author of a book, very prescient, People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates Knocking on Democracy's Door. Sayu, welcome to Wade's World.
Good morning, Wade. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And this book is so timely, and your work is so timely, because everybody is still in the, even though we have a federal shutdown, everybody is still clearly amazed at the new Congress. That must be a triumph for new American leaders.
Indeed, indeed. It's great to have the country catch up to something that we had been thinking about for a decade. And, you know, I'll just briefly say that one of the reasons that we have been doing the work of training first and second generation Americans to run for office, and the reason that I wrote the book, was because there were these amazing stories of immigrants who were stepping up to represent their communities. And in the media narrative and really the general conversation about immigrants tends to be about what they're contributing to our economy or what they're taking away from our country. And there had been very little conversation about what we add to democracy, especially as people who often come from places that don't have democratic governments or are coming to America to seek a better life. I think we're very invested in ensuring that America lives up to its best version of itself.
Well, and that's a project at the wide waterfront these days. But in your book, you mentioned how 2016 was the most diverse Congress ever. But this one is obviously a record breaker.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's always great to have these record breakers and to see the impact even before any legislation has passed, just the impact of having these faces and these voices. Because I think we don't want to lose track of, it's not diversity for diversity's sake. It's for the sake of having different perspectives and different voices and different ways of advocating. I just read an article about the end of quote-unquote likability politics. But actually, I would say that, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar are very likable. It's one of the reasons that people are so excited about them. They may not be playing by the rules, because the rules haven't worked for people like us, but that doesn't make them, that doesn't make them nasty women. It just makes them effective advocates.
And we need rules changed, and frankly, we need more nasty women. So you mentioned Ilhan Omar. That was one of the women that you profiled in your book.
Yes, Ilhan has such a great story, you know, as someone who became a state legislator only in 2016 and in many ways was at the right place at the right time. But of course, we can't, you know, just being at the right place at the right time is not enough, right? We can't discount. She ran a very smart strategy, and particularly in 2016, was very effective at mobilizing the youth vote and college students and a really diverse and strong coalition of supporters. And she was able to leverage that to run for Congress. You know, this was such an, 2018 was such an unusual year for Congress in terms of many people who ran and won even though they had not been in office before. And often the majority of Congress members tend to be people who are serving in local and state office. But in 2018, we did see several exceptions to that rule. So it's possible that Ilhan Omar would have won even if she wasn't a state legislator. But I think that it helped that she had run a strong campaign and a competitive campaign in 2016. It wasn't an easy road for her. But the campaign team had cut their teeth on a state campaign, and they really knew what to do to win a congressional campaign, which was even more competitive.
Well, and I think one of the points that your book made so ably, and it isn't part of the dominant narrative about our new leadership in Congress, is that many of these men and women had been in the trenches, school board races, city races, as you say, state legislature efforts in serving and pushing. One of your chapters about waiting your turn, I thought, was right on the money. What did you try to articulate there?
Well, what we hear from a lot of the people we work with at New American Leaders and the people I talk to about the book is that there's always a quote-unquote reason that they're given for why the time is not right. And often it's, a not-so-subtle way of implying that they're not American enough or they don't belong enough to the community. And so it's things like, well, your community doesn't vote. We're not sure that white voters will vote for a person of color, that type of thing. And part of what I wanted to articulate in that chapter is that if you wait around, it'll never be your turn.
Pardon? Yeah. Your time passes.
Well, and also, I mean, I do think that it's important that we think about term limits. And people have mixed opinions about term limits because, you know, there's a sense that we lose seniority when someone is term limited out. But when we look at who is in Congress now, you know, people who've been there for 20, 30, 40 years and no longer reflect not just the demographics of their districts, but even the ways that their voters have changed perspectives on things like healthcare coverage or on student debt. I think that the longer you are far removed from your constituents, and the fact is that in Congress, you know, you lead a very removed life. Unless you're super intentional about connecting with voters, you're kind of protected from what everyday Americans think. And so I think term limits, whether they're 12 or 16 or even 20 years, are worth considering, and it opens up the field to bring in new voices.
You made that point pretty strongly about a woman who'd been in office 44 years. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, going back to Ilhan Omar, she ran against an incumbent who had been there for 44 years, who, you know, I think initially, probably when she got elected, was very liberal and reflective of the district in terms of, again, not just demographics, but opinions and policies. But over time,
and was a woman.
Yes, and had become complacent, frankly. I think it's not just that she, maybe she was still able to think progressively, but was not necessarily acting as progressively as actively as her voters needed her to act. But also demographically, she no longer reflected the district, which was much younger, included many more immigrants and people of color. And I think we want to be really careful about the dynamic that we need to vote people out just for the sake of change. I think that it's important that, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez showed, that we need primaries. And she won, you know, she ran with the intention of waking up a group of voters and engaging a group of voters, and she ended up winning. And the message is you should take a shot at it. Now, you know, it's I just went to my kids' basketball game yesterday, and this is not unique advice, but the advice that my husband was giving her is that, you know, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take, right? And so if we're not taking a shot at things, we're never going to get access. And that's, I think, the message for everybody who's running for office right now or who's thinking about running for office right now, that it's always worth a shot. And for people who are in office, They need to be ready to be challenged. If you're doing a good job, you shouldn't be afraid of being challenged.
Well, you know, if we believe in democracy, we should believe in contest. And there's, you know, nothing wrong with people challenging whether they win or lose. It's a dare to struggle, dare to win. You connect this to an incumbency, whether or not we agree or don't agree about term limits or what they should be. There's no question that money has really become a huge wall for many new candidates to scale. And it helps these incumbents, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And I think that one of the ways it helps the incumbents is because, you know, we have a human tendency to want to stay, to kind of keep the devil we know, right? And if we've worked with someone, and so sometimes it's not so much that you're making an informed decision, but you're making a decision based on a pattern and a familiar way of doing things. And if you know the incumbent and you know that 50% of the time they'll vote with you on something, then it feels safer than somebody new. But I think what we saw in this election cycle and what's been amazing about many of the women who ran, not just for Congress, but in a lot of state ledge and city council seats, is that it's possible to run and win on small dollar donations. Like, you don't always need corporate PAC money. You don't always need big establishment money. I mean, let's not forget that certainly Rashida Tlaib in Michigan and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley for sure were not supported by the Democratic establishment. That they were, you know, Rashida was running in an open seat, but she wasn't the favored Democratic Party candidate. And of course, Alexandria and Ayanna ran against incumbents, Democratic incumbents. So these are women who, you know, didn't accept corporate PAC money, ran on small dollar donations, and were able to win. And there's many, many examples of those down ballot. So I don't want to imply that money doesn't matter, because it does, and it's having a very toxic effect on elections. One point I'll share is that, you know, what I heard as I went around the country is that people were in places like Arizona and Georgia, especially where there were big competitive gubernatorial races, people were getting very frustrated with the number of ads on television. And often those ads were not being funded by the candidates themselves. You know, they were funded by PACs who exactly had the kind of money. And so it's not just that those PACs are affecting who wins, but they're also going to affect how voters feel about elections if they're constantly being bombarded with one ad after another when they're just trying to watch reality TV or a football game.
Exactly. We're talking to Sally Ulwani, who has written a book, People Like Us, but also directs the New American Leaders Project. You must spend some fair amount of time talking to potential candidates in the New American Leaders sort of demographic, if you will, about how to do these small donor things. We read a lot of people, even at the presidential level, are saying that, certainly Beto O'Rourke was an example, refusing to take PAC dollars, refusing to take contributions over a certain level. Do you think that's going to be a progressive trend, or how do you think that's going to shake out?
You know, I think it's always important when the conversation is happening at more than one level. And so I think we can no longer say that this conversation about corporate PAC money or big dollar donations is happening only in, you know, by one or two campaigns. The fact that it's a more prevalent conversation, I think, is really important. And, you know, I don't think I need to tell your listeners this, that there is this kind of reckoning moment that the Democratic Party, I think, still has to have, even after this diverse cohort has been elected, of, you know, the corporate Democrat versus the more progressive Democrat for the people. And I think that that issue of corporate PAC money and big dollar donations is going to be an incredibly divisive issue, not just within the American public, but within the Democratic Party as well. And, you know, I feel optimistic that it's going to have a lot of traction, but I do think that it's going to create some divisions before it leads to more unity.
If you'd ever told me that in the presidential contest, a year and a half, 2 years out, that we would have Senator Elizabeth Warren, you know, going after Bloomberg and the Starbucks guy for not financing out of their own personal money a campaign for president. It's sort of like, what's going on here, Sayu? This is something that's a discussion at every level, and maybe that means we can hope or look for some change. But
you know, I want to tie it back to the congressional cohort for a second. I think sure. that what you're saying, you know, this is going to become normative. And I think that's an important part of what we're seeing with the women who've been elected to Congress, is that it's not just that one American Muslim woman won, it's that two of them won, and not just one Native American woman, but two.
Exactly.
And I think that when you have, I mean, sure, we need many more, but the fact that it's not just one really also is a very strong and powerful message to our young women and our young people that it's possible, that this is not just an exception, that more than one person did it, and so I can too. And I think Elizabeth Warren's challenge of candidates who are trying to self-fund their campaigns is another example of that you'll see more of it, and then it's harder to dismiss it as a one-off or as some kind of exception. And the more that we're able to make it normative, the more we're able to say, you know, it's not okay to self-fund your campaign. It's not okay to just have a campaign that's funded only by establishment donors and corporations. And I think the more that we see that, the more that the trend line will change to make democracy actually be a democratic process rather than a process for the wealthy and well-connected.
Exactly right. I mean, as one very, very, very small example, I know over the last 50 years, you couldn't, in an Acorn community, run for school board and get our support if you didn't have your children in public school. Well, that was normative then, and in the age of charters, for a lot of people, that's no longer normative. And it's what happened there. But Orange County, I love some of these stories about Orange County. My father was born and raised there. I, you know, still have relatives there, so have watched it from the far right. And what in the world? Look at the change in Congress and down to the local level in Orange County. Your book dealt with that quite extensively. I love that chapter. Or, you know, it wasn't more than a chapter. They came in and out. But isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the that's a great example of a place where, you know, people have really struggled with not just the fact that it has been there's been a strong Republican machine, but also the corporate Democrat issue has been quite powerful there. And to see the change that happened, really, I mean, it's obviously not just in one election cycle, right? Because these candidates were elected
Absolutely.
Because voters were mobilized. And the voters were mobilized because the infrastructure has been, Orange County has been the kind of beneficiary of foundation dollars and individual donor dollars, because they saw 5-6 years ago the fact that the demographics were changing, but that leadership wasn't changing in concert. And so, you know, as those things, those efforts were seeded in Orange County, and the organizations did more voter registration and voter education and getting out the vote, you know, that I think all contributed. Obviously, people were mobilized after Donald Trump got elected in 2016, but the pieces were in place, right? It's similar to what has been happening in Georgia. I mean, Stacey Abrams was a mobilizing force in the 2018 election cycle, but the seeds for that had been planted over the past 2-3 election cycles. And I only say that because, you know, we're all wringing our hands a lot about this political moment that we're in it right now. But I was saying to some folks yesterday that the fact is that I can still get on your radio program and say what I think about our democracy. People are still voting. People like Rashida and Alexandria and Ilhan are in office. And so there's a lot of room for hope about where we can go in 2-3 election cycles.
The only time we really lose is when we stop fighting.
Yes.
That's always the case. We're talking to Sayu Bhawani about her book, People Like Us, but we're really talking a lot about New American Leaders. So tell us, I know you started, founded the organization in 2010. Tell us more about what you and your organization do and have been doing on this exact front.
Our organization is committed to building a more inclusive democracy by encouraging more first and second generation Americans to not only run for office, but then to continue to be movement leaders once they are in office. And so we help recruit and train folks to run, and then once they're in office, we support them in their leadership journey to ensure that they don't become part of the system or drop out of the system, right? Because in order for the system to change, we need people in government who understand that the system is not working for most of us. And so we're really committed not only to getting new voices into government, but to ensuring that those new voices are being vocal and staying true to our values. And what those values are, very simply, is about making America work for everyday Americans. So although my book and the work I do is focused on immigrants, the goal is to get more leaders in place who reflect everyday Americans. And so just a couple of things I want to say for listeners who might be interested in running for office. Our website is newamericanleaders.org. We do a series of trainings around the country. And what's different about our trainings is that we are teaching a new campaign playbook. And in that new campaign playbook, we're saying that when you tell your story to voters, you can talk about who you are authentically. You don't have to shy away from your working class, immigrant, LGBTQ background. You can show up in your full humanity. You can connect to voters of all backgrounds using values-based language. We also talk about expanding the electorate and not just knocking on the doors of voters who have voted in the last 1, 2, 3 elections, but knocking on the doors of voters who have never voted, who are not registered, who just became citizens, and inviting them to the Democracy Party. And we also talk a lot about money and how many of us who come from working class backgrounds and immigrant backgrounds are taught to be, coy about money and not put ourselves out there and not put our money issues out there. And that makes us shy to engage in conversations about money. But when people contribute to your campaign, they're making an investment in you, they're making an investment in their community, and they're becoming part of democracy, even if they're just giving a $5 contribution. And so we really address the money issue, the voter issue, and the personal story issue head on in ways that, frankly, that first and second generation Americans have never had an opportunity to do. And then you go through a weekend training, and then we support you after the training up until the point you decide to run. Once you declare that you're running, because we are a nonpartisan organization, we don't get involved in your election. But once you win, then we support you, connect you to elected officials across the country, other people like you who are trying to change the system so that it works better for all of us. So our website, again, is newamericanleaders.org. Our training has a small fee, but we provide lots of scholarships because money shouldn't be a barrier to be involved in democracy.
Well, and since we're talking about money, Sayu, I've got to tell you that the only chapter in your book that really surprised me, but it was so authentic and so very, very true, is you go into some detail about, we talk about working class, low and moderate income candidates, what you actually get paid to be in public office is an issue.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact is that our system was designed to work
Papers
for wealth.
Hate to say it.
Yeah, well, and also, yeah. I mean, in a world when, you know, the people who were running for office or running our government were wealthy, white, landowning males, it made perfect sense to just get paid for, you know, 40 days of meetings a year, because that was the government that worked for that moment, or at least for a certain group of people. But today in Georgia, if the legislators are only meeting 40 days a year, that means that your representative is only being compensated for 40 days of fighting on your behalf. And that's completely outdated for today's America. I often compare it to our school system, which was designed for an agrarian society. It makes no sense now to have working parents whose kids are home from school for 2 to 3 months a year. And so if we need to update our democracy in order for it to work for everyone, we need to make sure that our legislators are compensated fairly and are available to work for us every single day of the year.
Exactly. And it was interesting to me how strong the theme of some union experience came through in your book, too. I mean, the fact that often support for some of our more progressive candidates depends on the nonprofit sector and where labor has some strength still.
Right. I mean, I just want to underline that we're talking about salaries of $24,000 to $30,000 a year in places like Arizona, Colorado, and Georgia, and those salaries have not even been adjusted for inflation over the last 20 years. So, you know, I think we have to be cognizant that many Americans are struggling to make ends meet, and that nobody is feeling like their legislators need to be highly compensated, but I think we're talking about fair compensation so that people don't feel like they have to choose between public life and taking care of their families. They don't have to choose between showing up to the legislature and going to, you know, their child's for paying their mortgage and that sort of thing. I think those are very basic choices that no one should have to make.
Well, and of course, we've had some very interesting issues around people using campaign funds to pay for daycare for women who are mothers who are trying to balance both of those things. And that's
right.
An important issue for people to finally deal with. But, I mean, I know here in the South, that's still ongoing. I mean, some of those issues are not resolved in the favor of women yet.
Right. I mean, it's been addressed at the federal level, but needs to be addressed statewide or countrywide.
Trickle down thing is a problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that now at the federal level, we got to trickle up. So what are you, since we have some, obviously one of the challenges for the new leaders in Congress is how to navigate, I mean, you mentioned corporate Democrats versus our new Democrats, we'll call them, but also just the whole problem of the age of Trump. How do you see that from your perspective? I bet you're hearing from some of the candidates you've worked with who are now in elected office about how to navigate that sort of balance beam.
Well, look, I think many of them ran because Donald Trump became president, right? And so I think that they're not going to – and also, as I said earlier, they were not supported by the establishment. So at the moment, I think that there is a sense that there's nothing to lose, right? That, you know, yes, it's true that you have to be in the system while you're changing the system, which is always hard. But at the same time, they don't really have an obligation to the party or to the establishment because that's not why they got elected. They got elected by sheer, you know, people power. And so, as long as their voters are happy with the way that they're doing things, I think they're going to keep challenging the powers that be, whether that's Donald Trump or whether that's the party establishment. You know, and I also think that, obviously, you know, we've been around the block a few times. There's what is aired out in public and what is discussed in private. And, you know, as you said, that's a balance beam that that we're seeing them walk, but we don't actually know what's going on in the private conversations. And I know that when I was commissioner of immigrant affairs for New York City, I was in the executive branch, but we worked with the legislative branch and community organizations outside the system to ensure that the pieces worked together in order for us to move policy. So I think the smartest and most strategic advocates know how to balance private conversation with public presence. And I think these women are some of the smartest and boldest people we've seen. So I have no doubt that they're doing what it takes to get the job done.
It's on the job training and they're going to be great. There's no question about that. The one thing we didn't get to cover, and we're sort of running out of time, but I'll just keep pushing people back towards your book, is these local races, particularly in the state legislatures and now redistricting, gerrymandering, those two things are so closely connected, and the job the Republicans were able to do over recent years is part of what the residue of what we're dealing with over and over again now. And you make the point about how important these races are. So before we talk more about how people can get your book, any quick comments you have on that other than big red lights and going off that we need to keep pushing new candidates?
Well, two things I would say. One is people should show up to all their local community meetings, their school board meetings, their city council meetings. I think even if you're not going to run, I think we want our elected officials to know that we're paying attention to what they're doing. And the second thing is let's not get distracted by the presidential election. For the next 2 years, that's all that we're going to hear about in most of our media. But the work is getting done at the local and state level. And so people really need to keep vigilant about what's going on, because the more distracted we get by what's happening nationally, the more that our local and state folks are going to be, if they're more, very progressive, they're not going to feel supported. And if they're doing things that we don't like, we're not going to notice if we're being distracted by national politics. So I think those two things are my pieces of advice, if you will. And then, you know, the
people like us, Sayu Bhavani, and the website is newamericanleaders.org. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's where you can find more information, and I'm sure you can find out how to get the book there as well. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, and we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement to our sister stations WDSV 91.9 FM in Greenville, Mississippi, and KABF 88.3 FM in Little Rock, Arkansas. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.